Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of January, 2017. Welcome to episode 20 of this podcast series. We're coming up on the 2-year anniversary in a few months. Terrific. The concept of this show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes it pretty much the books I read during January. Although technically speaking, it's the books that appear on my weekly reading list entries at eyesandearsblogspot.com that were posted during January. And I regularly repost those lists on Facebook and Twitter, so you can find them. Those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists, and here we do a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. Now remember that the spring semester at my university began in January, and I'm teaching one class I haven't taught in more than a decade, and another one I'm teaching in a different format than I ever have before. So let's just say I ended up spending a lot more time in January not reading comics than I'd hoped. So this episode may be a bit shorter than average. But first, a little feedback. And actually, it's feedback from myself on last month's episode. I am a subscriber to the network, and I listen to the shows as they come out, mostly because I want to see if there are any audio issues. I want to experience the shows in the same way that listeners will. And I appreciate that no listener pointed out an obvious problem with last month's reading journal. But boy, did I notice when I listened. And that is that I talked way too fast in that episode. That's probably because I knew it was going to be long with the Listener of the Year discussion, the Top 10 Countdown. But for whatever reason, it was hard for me to listen to. And to those of you who felt the same way, I apologize. And to those of you who felt the same way, but didn't think I'd want to hear that, I appreciate the impulse to be kind, but please, feel free to let me know, and you can do it privately, but feel free to let me know if there are any production issues or any other constructive critique that you may have on an episode or on the podcast in general. And that applies not just to the reading journal, but for anything we have going on here at Relatively Geeky. I did want to give a shout-out to Nicholas Prom of the Comic Reflections podcast. The show features Nicholas and a rotating group of co-hosts talking about different books from different eras of comics. With episode 283, he took inspiration from this very show to reformat the shows that he does with co-host Spencer Valadez. On monthly episodes, the two of them will be having a conversation about the comics that they read the prior month. I appreciate the shout-out, Nicholas, and encourage listeners to check out that show if you haven't before. And now, on to the books I read during January. As I do on this show, I'm categorizing or classifying the books that I read. And first are the issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances. We call them the homework books. I will be appearing, or maybe have already appeared, on an upcoming, or perhaps very recent, episode of Back to the Bins. For that show, I read Doom Patrol 122 and Incredible Hulk 144. Major Hulk versus Dr. Doom action in that last one, by the way. Listen to me and Paul and the Hair Metal Hero talk about these two issues, as well as a book I talked about here about 6 months ago, The Return of Skyman. For episode 89 of The Quarter Bin, I read Doom 2099, 11 through 13. This run includes a really nice two-parter that talks about the goings-on in Wakanda in 2099. So for more details, go back and listen to that episode. And for the upcoming episode 90 of that show, I read The Enemy Ace Special from 1990 that reprinted Hans Van Hammer's first two appearances from 25 years before 1965. There's a super secret project that I have coming way down the road. And for that, I read Action Comics 715 and 717, Justice League Europe 7, Hawkworld 1, that's the ongoing, and Morbius the Living Vampire 5, that's from the 90s version of that title. And I read some comics for listening to podcasts. I read pages 176 to 196 of the Xenozoic trade paperback to follow along with Ruth and Darren Sutherland. They covered that story on episode 7 of their excellent Xenozoic Xenophiles podcast. And for episode 1 of the all-new, all-futuristic Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes on the Fire and Water Network, co-hosted by members of the Legion of Super Bloggers, along with, really can't remember who the main host was, but anyway, I read Who's Who in the Legion of Superheroes 1 and 2. Then on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC, here in the Rebirth era. Emily and I finally had our talk about Rebirth back in the recently released Short Box 48. So for our detailed thoughts on some of these books, check that episode out. But I'm going to continue talking here about the books that I'm regularly reading. Green Arrow 14 and 15 continues the Emerald Outlaw storyline. Ollie's been framed for the very public murder of the quarterback of the Seattle football team. Live, during a game, we learn who actually did this, and they have connections to Ra's al Ghul and the League of Assassins. And we learn that this mysterious archer is indeed someone from Ollie's past. And then he goes up against a former cop bent on wiping out the criminal underbelly, and he's saved by someone else from his past. Because Ollie has a lot of people from his past. This person calls themselves Red Arrow. Green Lanterns 10 through 12. I'm actually a little bit behind on this one. In the transition from just buying books off the shelves to starting our pull list, we actually missed an issue. So I've got a couple of the newer issues that have piled up while I just got to head back to the shelves and find the one that we're missing. So anyway, I'm a little bit behind on this one, but we have Simon and Jessica facing up against the Phantom Lantern. This is a dude who just wanted to be a hero, really, but a misguided guardian? I know what you're thinking. Aren't all the guardians misguided? Well, anyway, this misguided guardian lets him have the Phantom Ring, which responds to every emotion on the spectrum. So it's a little hard to control, and when avarice or rage are in the driver's seat, it's really hard for Simon and Jessica to get him under control, but they try their best. It's kind of like that movie Inside Out, except all of the emotions have power rings associated with them. DC Bombshells 21, we spend most of this issue in Zambezi, with Cheetah and Hawkgirl and Catwoman, and others seeking out mystical or occult artifacts in order to keep Hitler from getting them. And then we learn at the end that someone on the team may be colluding with Luther. Trinity 5, continuing the Black Mercy arc, Poison Ivy is trying to bring Mongol, or maybe it's just Mongol's child, to our world, and she knows that the Kent Farm, for some weird reason, has the right sun energy power to accomplish this. And Ivy does legitimately wonder why Wonder Woman and Bruce Wayne are friends with this nobody farm family. This one got a little weird in this particular issue, but I'm looking forward to how the arc will wrap up. Wonder Woman 13 and 14. Steve and Diane are at the location of where Themyscira should be, but isn't, and she has some sort of mental break. And then they're attacked, and then members of the team can't be reached, and Steve is scared, and then the year one storyline ends with Diana battling Ares and battling his influence in our world. And at the end, the world gives her the title, the name, Wonder Woman. And on to the general comic reading that I did. I'm not sure where I got this one from, but a listener did send it in. I didn't make a note of it, although I almost always do that. But thanks to whoever sent Jerry Iger's Famous Features number 1. From what I can tell, this may have been issue only. It was a Golden Age reprint comic put out by Pacific in 1984. We get a story featuring Flamingo, a gypsy woman returning to Dorset after some time battling Nazis. It's a story with a magical twist, of course, because gypsies. And then there's an Ace of the Newsreel story about famed photographer and his lady sidekick, and a story featuring Wonder Boy, a character from the mid-50s. So, a pretty fun read, all in all. From great listener Clinton Robinson of the Coffee and Comics blog and Coffee and Comics podcast, I recently received a few books, including Dreadstar 53. I had never read an issue of this, but Peter David did a pretty good job bringing me up to speed, and then telling a pretty gripping story. This one also had a chapter of an illustrated prose novel by Jim Starlin. And I love illustrated novels. And even though I hadn't read the first 11 chapters, this was nonetheless a pretty good read. I ended up reading a bunch of kids' books this month, so I'm going to go over a bunch of them right here. I mentioned last episode that I had a bunch of Christmas or winter-themed Archie collections. Well, there was one more that I didn't get to last year, so I got to it a little late here in early 2017, and that was Archie's Funhouse Christmas Annual. It was a collection of mostly modern stories featuring the whole gang, including Chuck and his dad, Coach Clayton, Moose and Midge, Dilton Doily, Little Archie, and Jingles the Elf. Yes. Archie had its own version of a fifth-dimensional imp. More Great Gazoo than Mixius Middlepick, but still not my favorite addition to the Archie cast. One story did stand out in this collection because it was full-length, as opposed to the standard five- or six-pager. One of the Jingles the Elf stories ran 23 pages. It was an Archie take on Groundhog Day, and sort of worked. Overall, it's a pretty enjoyable collection. Another Archie book that I read was from the great Kansan, Greg Arujo, and that was Archie's Pal, Jughead, number 71. This is from 1995, and it's actually a notable issue in two ways. One, the story is about the revelation of the name of Jughead's baby sister. He does not want it to get out for some reason. But Reggie is determined to discover this Jughead family secret. And two, the story is continued in the next issue. I'm not claiming that this is the first time that that ever happened in an Archie comic, but it is the first time that I've run across it. So, I still don't know the name of the sister. Greg also sent along Spotlight, number 1, or Marvel Comics Hanna-Barbera Spotlight Huckleberry Hound. Whew. This is a book from 78, and in light of the current Hanna-Barbera comic book renaissance that's going on over at DC, it was fun to read this one from almost 40 years ago, from the other big publisher. One interesting thing about the issue is that it was almost all one long story. It was a three-page backup, but other than that, it was, again, an almost book-length epic featuring Huckleberry, Yogi, and Boo Boo, and an alien invasion. And there are references to the Jetsons and other Hanna-Barbera properties, so it was a weird combination of being metatextual and also, these things don't necessarily fit together. But it was a quick, fun read, and the only drawback was hearing all of Huckleberry Hound's dialogue as Luke Giaconetti doing his impression of Huckleberry Hound. Greg also sent Peanuts number 2. This was a 2012 book from Kaboom. That was a mix of new 4-to-6-page stories and classic Charles Schulz Sunday strips repurposed as one-pagers. It was a very high-quality book in terms of the paper and the cover stock, and they were quick read, sure, but they were all pretty good. If you like Peanuts, or know someone young who might, I would recommend checking out any of these four issues from the run, or look for the trade that collects them. The generous Canadian, Rob Lance, of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, included some old kid books in his recent Christmas care package. Devil Kid Starring Hot Stuff, number 35, is a Harvey book from 1968. This came out when I was about 3 years old, so this may have actually been a reread for me, for all I know. There were some one-page gags, but there's not a lot to do with this character over more than five or six pages, and which I think they recognized because they sent him to Mars for one story. Weird stuff, not great, but not bad. Hot Stuff Sizzlers, number 26, was a giant-sized book from even earlier, 1966. And this came with the unreasonably high cover price of, I shudder to even mention it, 25 cents. Now, this one was better than the one I just mentioned because it had more variety. I was not previously familiar with the comic book antics of Stumbo the Giant, but his couple of stories in here really broke up the Hot Stuff stories, which do get to be a bit repetitive. But there were enough other stories in here, and a few of the Hot Stuff stories were really imaginative, like the trip to Mars I mentioned previously. Those helped make this a pretty decent read. All right, time to play a promo here. And when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, long runs, and graphic novels that I read in January.
When you talk about comics, does it sound something like this?
Look, you can't put the Superman number 77s with the 200s. They haven't even discovered red kryptonite yet. And you can't put the number 98s with the 300s. Lori Lamaris hasn't even been introduced.
Or maybe it sounds a little more like this.
You think Mighty Mouse could beat up Superman?
What are you, cracked?
Why not? I saw the other day he was carrying five elephants in one hand.
Boy, you don't know nothing. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman is a real guy. No way a cartoon could beat up a real guy.
Yeah, maybe you're right. It would be a good fight, though.
Hello, I am the constantly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and my comics discussions can go to both extremes, but generally fall somewhere in between. On the Coffee and Comics podcast, I will review comic stories and other comics-related topics that can be enjoyed over a cup of coffee. So pour the coffee, or other beverage of choice, and join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on iTunes and coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com.
And we're back. Next up, the trades and graphic novels, miniseries, long runs that I read. And a shout-out goes to my good buddy and actual in-real-life neighbor, Terry Colucci, who gave me a handful of comics for Christmas, including Wonder Man 6 and 7. I was excited at first to see that these are written by Gerard Jones. But breaking news in the intervening weeks made me less excited when I actually sat down to read them. But anyway, the first featured Wonder Man and Beast going up against the Rampages, and that was a pretty solid standalone issue. The second issue, number 7, was a bit more confusing as it was part of the Operation Galactic Storm storyline, and I was not much of a Marvel guy in 1992, so this is one I have no knowledge of, except that it was a battle between the Kree and the Shi'ar empires. So it was a little confusing, because just reading one issue of a, whatever it is, 19-part miniseries or something, it was an issue that pretty much worked for me as well as it could. I like the notion of basing heroes on the West Coast, so I have an inherent bent towards Wonder Man and the West Coast Avengers teams and characters like that. Marvel has some real advantages in their storytelling, I think, by basing their characters in quote-unquote real cities. But when they're all in New York City, they lose a bunch of that this-is-the-real-world goodwill that they've built up, at least to me. So like I said, I like the concept of the West Coast heroes. So again, this one worked for me. over the last few months, I've talked here about reading a bunch of King Conan issues, many of which came from the great Canadian Rob Lance. Well, one day, I was poking around on the Hoopla app and stumbled upon the King Conan collections that were there. This was a huge surprise, because Marvel is not on Hoopla, because they have Marvel Unlimited. But with the change of the license, which Dark Horse has picked up, I guess they've picked up the reprint rights to the Marvel comics. And thus, the King Conan collections are on Hoopla. So I read King Conan, issues 2, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 16, and 17. And like I said in previous episodes, I really dig these early issues of the title. Issue 2 here, for example, was one of the ones that was based on pre-existing short stories. Issues 5 through 7 told the story of a younger Conan on an action-packed mission to rescue his queen. And by action-packed, I mean he did take a little detour on the mission to rescue his one true love, to have a little quality time with a beautiful yellow-skinned lady person that he happens to rescue along the way. These issues were by Roy Thomas, John Buscema, and little Ernie Chan, and it was a great story. After that run, Doug Mensch wrote issues 9 and 10, and they were one-offs, and that was a good change of pace, because these stories do run 35 to 40 pages, so that's plenty of time to tell a full, complete story. The last two I mentioned above for this month are from the Alan Zelenitz run, with Mark Silvestri doing most of the art, and they were okay. They also lacked the overarching plot from earlier runs, which I thought was kind of unique, but on the other hand, a nicely crafted one-and-done is a nice read every now and then. But like I said, last time I talked about King Conan, every writer change as the run went on dropped the quality of the book a bit. And after these issues, I've now read all of the first 18, along with a couple others from later in the run. And since they're all on Hoopla, I imagine I'll read a bunch more of these as the year goes by. I do hope that it picks up a bit. I don't know what creative teams were on the book as the series rolls on, but I like the characters. I like the setup of the series. I like the older Conan, either having adventures or, in a few cases, you know, regaling others with stories of his youth. But I just like that setup, and I am interested in reading more. I've talked a couple of times about the Hanna-Barbera properties that DC has turned into really well thought of comics the past few years. And so I picked up the first trade of one of those titles just to see what all the fuss was about. Scooby-Doo Team-Up 1 through 6. Wow. 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 What an absolute delight to read. This is the classic Scooby team teaming up with folks from across the DCU. We start with the Bat Family, including a classic take on the dynamic duo. We basically get the Super Friends versions of these characters. They take on Man-Bat, and then Scarecrow, and then Batmite. They do so well working with Batman and Robin in those first three issues that the Teen Titans contact them. But this is the TV version of those characters, and the Scooby team is very confused about this different version of Robin. They round out the action with a terrific issue with Wonder Woman and another really good issue with the whole Super Friends team. These stories were terrifically funny. Sholly Fish totally gets what the series is supposed to be. It was a true delight. Loved it. Action Comics, 852 through 854. This was a Jimmy Olsen arc that Clinton Robinson sent a while back. It's in the Countdown era, 2007, and involves the Kryptonite Man, and because it's a DC comic, a range of empowered monkeys. I'm using the word monkey in a generic sense, you understand. And Jimmy Olsen is manifesting a range of powers, which reflect many of his past transformations. He eventually takes up the mantle of Action Man, with occasional stretchy powers, occasional invulnerability powers, sort of whatever he needs at the exact moment he needs it. These issues were all written by Kurt Busiek and drawn by Brad Walker. And even having read only a handful of Astro City issues, I can definitely see the Busiek take on heroes in these issues. Maybe it's just that one of the very few Astro City issues I've ever read involved giant apes, so I may be imagining other connections because of the monkey connection. But I think that focusing on Jimmy here, telling the story through his eyes, with the traditional powered beings existing just as part of the world building, just as part of the background, all of that stuff seemed very Busiek, or at least very Astro City, which is a good thing. These are three quite fun issues. I have no idea what super fans think of this run, of this era, of this arc. But sometimes, being disconnected from a larger, greater fandom can be a good thing. So with no context to the greater super world, I enjoyed these. A lot. Blackhawk 1 through 5, this is the Marty Pasco and Rich Burchett series from 1989, it takes place after the Chaikin Mini and after the Action Comics Weekly issues that I covered on the Action Comics Weekly podcast with Little Chad Action Comics Weekly Bokelman. I'm not going to say that I don't like this, but I think I liked those other stories more. This one just jumped around a bit too much for me. There was not a single through line that I found myself latching onto. It was an issue that seemed to make fun of the comic book business, that also took on the Wortham hearings. But then we had political stuff, and blackmail, and intrigue, and a mishmash of character interactions. I just never figured out a storyline or a character arc that propulsed me onward. I mean, if I see the next couple of these cheap, I'd consider picking them up. I like the Blackhawk team enough for that, but these ones just didn't work for me quite as much as I would have liked them to have. And then we close with some more Rebirth. These are ones that I got off the Hoopla app. And that's Batman, the Rebirth issue, and 1 through 6. This is the story of Gotham and Gotham Girl. From a few podcasts, like the DC Weekly Reads show on the Comic Book Noise feed, I've heard a bit about these issues, about these new characters. So I wasn't a complete blank slate going into this, but I didn't know any of the details. And it was a good read, I'd say. It's Batman and these two new characters against Professor Hugo Strange and the Psycho Pirate. I didn't know what to make of Gotham and Gotham Girl, if they were going to turn out to be characters we knew from before, or versions of characters like a Rebirth take on Knight and Squire or something like that. But Tom King took the story a different way, and I think he got the emotional core of Batman and a Batman story pretty much right on target for me. I'm not so sure that I dug the plot, that I followed every step from A to B to C, but it felt to me like the way I want my Batman comics to feel. And Superman, the Rebirth issue, and 1 through 6. And look, I like Superman well enough, but I'm not part of Superman fandom. But I know that almost everyone who is a part of Superman fandom was beyond angered by the take on the Man of Steel in the New 52. And maybe had been displeased for up to a dozen years or so before that. But the Rebirth take, across most if not all the Superbooks, has been welcomed warmly by the fans of Steel. So when Rebirth trades showed up on Hoopla, this was the first one I borrowed. This is the Son of Superman storyline, and it was really, really good. Through the Trinity book, I've become a fan of this Superman and his relation to his wife Lois and the son John. And here we have John just coming into his powers with a tragic scene demonstrating the overuse or lack of control of his powers. Superman is not sure how the rest of the hero community will handle a halfway-powered young half-Kryptonian. They don't totally trust this new fully-powered, fully-Kryptonian, so he's still trying to keep himself, and John even more so, secret. But his presence on Earth has been noticed by the Eradicator. The Eradicator only wants pure-blood Kryptonians around, and he comes to kill John. And Superman don't like that much, and they have quite the throwdown. Like I said, really good read. And I don't have as much invested in the success of this character as others do. I'm not as proprietary about Superman as many others are. But this was a characterization of the character that I definitely recognized, and I liked spending some time with this guy. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, those early NMEA stories are legitimate classics. Some of the Rebirth books are solid. Some of the funny books were quite funny. And those early issues of King Conan really do stand out. But I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. Scooby-Doo Team-Up is an absolute delight start to finish. I'm tempted to go with issue 2 because of Ace the Bat-Hound, but just edging that one out for my favorite read of the month is the Wonder Woman issue, Scooby-Doo Team-Up number 5. Next month, even though February has fewer days than January does, I expect to maybe read a few more comics. But we'll find out when that next episode comes out, which ought to be sometime in early March. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com. Or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode, the blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. And thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.